Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Affney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. We have our work cut out for us, as it turns out, when it comes to protecting the country we love. It's pretty much the full-time job of our Center for Security Policy. It animates our research and analysis, our programming here at Securing America, the webinars that we do with our assorted partners in groups like the Committee on the Present Danger, China, and Stop Vaccine Passports, the Sovereignty Coalition, Secure the Grid, and more. I really want to encourage all of you to take advantage of these resources because they certainly inform the work we're doing, but we hope they will inform you. Well, and the work we hope you're doing as well to try to protect the country we love at this very dangerous moment. A man who understands the dangers of this moment, who is a member of many of our teams, including our Committee on the Present Danger China, who is also a senior fellow with us at centerforsecuritypolicy.org, is our first guest. His name is Sam Faddis. We have the real privilege of being able to visit with him each week about this time. And we look forward to it mightily because there are few people who I admire more, both for the service he's rendered to our country and the United States Army as undercover operative of the Central Intelligence Agency, as well as what he's doing these days, which is a real public service at andmagazine.com, at substack.com. And it's a prodigiously important source of information for this program and for, I hope, all of you as well. Sam Faddis, welcome back to Securing America, my friend. It's great to have you with us.
Great, as always, to be here. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Let me start by sort of doing some stock taking, Sam. We had, of course, in Washington this week, a big display of allied unity. We had the Prime Minister of Japan. We had the President of the Philippines in, meeting with President Biden, being a tripartite summit, it was called. The Prime Minister of Japan, Fumio Kishida, also addressed a joint session of Congress. And the leitmotif of it all, I think, was, you know, we're all in this together and we're cognizant of the dangers we're facing from the Chinese Communist Party and manning up to defend Western civilization from the CCP. I want to do just a reality check here with you, my friend. What is the kind of subtext here? And more to the point, what is the Biden administration actually doing that seems very much at odds with that messaging?
Well, I mean, you know, we seem to come back to this all the time, right? We have discussions about what meeting just took place in D.C. or where what carrier battle group is or all of this. And we ignore the not inconsequential fact that the guy sitting in the Oval Office, by my count, as best I can tell, has taken something like $31 million from guys directly tied to Chinese intelligence. So not just has some business dealings in China or other things, which might themselves be things we should be concerned about. But no, I mean, Chinese spies have funneled millions of dollars directly to him.
And you're making a distinction between what's been reported in terms of some of that going to his son, Hunter. But you're saying Joe Biden, President of the United States, Commander-in-Chief of our armed forces, has taken personally something on the order of $31 million Chinese intelligence?
As best I can tell, that is certainly my opinion. And and again, I mean,
your informed opinion, I think, is the point.
One would hope, yes. Yeah. And as a guy who did this for a living for a long time, we lived in this world. I mean, I keep coming back to, I mean, here's a fact. The tip of the spear for the Chinese in this whole thing with contacts with the Bidens and funneling money was a guy who went by the name Patrick Ho in the United States of America. All right, well, we don't have to wonder who Patrick Ho was or what he was up to because the Bureau arrested him, Department of Justice prosecuted him, and he went to federal prison on our soil for buying foreign officials on behalf of the Chinese government. We only prosecuted him for the money he gave to Uganda and Chad, as if memory serves. At the same time, the exact same things that he was doing that we put him in prison for, he was doing with the Biden crime family. And yet the DOJ chose to just walk on by. So now we're seriously going to have Joe Biden sitting in the White House in the Oval Office and pretend like we do not know this, and as if he's acting in good faith and his administration is acting in good faith. Yeah. I mean, you know,
ludicrous. Sam, we have, as you say, returned to this theme a lot because, for heaven's sakes, it screams out, at least to, you know, people who have some experience with national security, as a flashing red danger light. You've made a very interesting point in some of our previous conversations, and I just have to insert a quote that I cite endlessly, is your assessment of what this arrangement actually translates into, right, in terms of Joe Biden being a controlled asset of the Chinese Communist Party. You've on occasion remarked that there's no such thing as an uncontrolled asset. Right. You're either controlled or you're actually a liability.
Yeah.
So when Joe Biden is sitting in the Oval Office, and look, you know, obviously our team has to know of this compromise, but surely so do the Japanese and the Filipinos. What's going on in their heads as they calculate the quality of the kind of commitment that they're hearing from us? And we'll talk in a minute about, so what other evidence is it that this may not be all that is cracked up to be in the region? But just at this level of leadership, what are your thoughts, sir?
Well, you know, my thoughts are that MSNBC and company can choose to pretend like they can't see this if they choose. That doesn't actually alter reality, and it doesn't alter reality for the Filipinos, the Taiwanese, the South Koreans, the Japanese, for everybody else. They're seeing this and understand that the enemy is inside the wire here. We are compromised. And therefore, you are now in a reality where you really have to face the prospect that when the balloon goes up, you are completely on your own. And each one of them will obviously, therefore, make their calculation as to what that means. I'm in Manila. I may stand with you, the United States, if I believe I can rely upon you face to face with the dragon. But if I'm on my own, well, no, I'm not throwing down with the Chinese. That's not happening. I will have to accommodate myself to the new reality. And that is, it's not a, as with so many things we talk about, not a distant prospect, not like one day we may face this. It is happening right now.
And that would mean, I guess, that somewhere in their systems, these countries are figuring out that they either have to go it alone, notwithstanding treaty commitments that we have to them, or they maybe partner up with each other without us, or, Sam, that they're contemplating a separate peace with the Chinese. And I'm not saying that the two leaders who've been here in Washington this week fall into the latter category, but I imagine there are people in their governments that have. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about the implications of all of that, not just for our friends and allies and interests over there, but for us here at home. Stay tuned for more with the great Sam Faddis right after this. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Yesterday, Japan's Prime Minister Fumio Kishida urged Americans to overcome, quote, an undercurrent of self-doubt about our role in a world now at history's turning point, unquote. Actually, what millions of us are doubting is the quality of our leadership at such a moment. Top congressmen warn that we're in a new Cold War with the Chinese Communist Party and are finally launching hearings into the CCP's political warfare here. There's an elephant in the room, however, that is yet to be formally acknowledged, let alone corrected. As retired CIA spy Sam Faddis has observed, in the lexicon of recruiting and running agents, President Joe Biden would be characterized as, quote, a controlled asset of the Chinese Communist Party, unquote. We can't win a Cold War, let alone the now looming hot one, with a leader whose loyalty and conduct we have plenty of reason to doubt. This is Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and we're continuing our weekly conversation with Sam Faddis, former CIA undercover operative, and who conducted himself with great distinction in very dangerous places around the world on our behalf. We cannot adequately express our appreciation for that, as well as the work that he does these days at AND Magazine at Substack.com. Sam, I wanted just to tease out a little bit further, having talked about how our allies in the region are making what sense they can of this situation where we have what you call a controlled asset of the Chinese Communist Party sitting in the Oval Office of the United States and discussing with them what needs to be done to protect against the CCP. What do you think the Chinese Communist Party is making of this arrangement? Would you anticipate that it is emboldening them to act ever more aggressively, not just again in the region, not just against the Japanese or the Filipinos or even the Taiwanese, but against us as well, perhaps here at home?
Yeah, well, again, it seems like with a number of these matters, I mean, part of the answer is tradecraft and intelligence and how this world works, which is a little arcane. And part of it is just reality and common sense and the way people work. I mean, if you've gotten a guy to take $31 million from you over a course of years, and I would submit to you, by this point, you have a track record of one decision after another that favors communist China to the detriment of the United States of America. You do not then strategically make moves and plan and ignore this. This must become the centerpiece of what you're doing. We have achieved unthinkable success. We have a completely I'm speaking now as, you know, from the Chinese perspective. We got a completely compromised guy sitting in the Oval Office. You don't then plan your moves against Taiwan or anybody else and ignore this central reality, which is why, you know, we've had so many conversations about timing. Okay, are you as Xi going to wait until, I mean, let's assume, for instance, Donald Trump wins the November election. Are you then going to wait until he sits down in the Oval Office to really make your big move on things? As it becomes increasingly likely that that may happen, are you going to ignore that? Obviously not. I mean, this has long since shifted from one of these days we may have a problem to, no, guys, we got a problem right now, Houston. Like today got a problem.
Yeah. And Sam, I guess this comes back to the point that we were just discussing a moment ago about, you know, a controlled asset. If Joe Biden is under the control of the Chinese Communist Party, not only is the opportunity perceived to be advantageous to the CCP, but the prospect that he would actually do what they tell him to do in the course of whatever attack they are going to mount, and it could run the gamut, as you know better than just about anybody, from cyber to biological to physical sabotage and so on. That has to be, I think, uppermost in our minds. And again, it brings me back to a point that with your help, we distilled out of the myriad webinars that our Committee on the Present Danger China sponsored, co-sponsored by the Center for Security Policy. And you can find out all about it at centerforsecuritypolicy.org, as well as at presentdangerchina.org. But we talked about the fact that along with lots of other friends of China, captured elites, as they're called, the president is in a position to do even more harm. I think you said his track record bespeaks a predilection for doing the bidding. I think it's an unbroken track record, actually. I think you do, yes, too. So if push comes to shove and you know, the move against Taiwan is in the offing, I think we agree that Joe Biden would probably be susceptible to being told to help the success of that operation here. And why, as we say in the indictment, you don't want people who have this kind of record anywhere near the reins of power, do you?
As we've said before, the man could not get a job on the loading dock at the Central Intelligence Agency. With all his contacts, screams off the paper. Look, if the I've said this many times, the Chinese flip on a blockade of Taiwan tomorrow, which we both know they're in the, they could do that anytime. The only thing missing is the announcement that it's in place, because the ships, the aircraft are there already all day, every day. Will Joe Biden order a breaking of that blockade and move? No. He will issue some sort of statement. He will ask for the UN to hold discussions. This Taiwanese will starve. They will knuckle under. They will become the next Hong Kong, and he will watch. And it, can anybody say, given what you know factually about his contacts, the money that has flowed to him, his track record of decisions, are you really going to be able to write a history book after that and say, wow, we didn't see that one coming? That was a shocker. I mean, talk about the elephant in the room. This is the biggest elephant in history
ever, arguably. Yeah. You know, it's often said history is written by the victors. So this one is not likely to be told from our preview, needless to say, unless we get cracking on getting on a war footing and getting people like Joe Biden out of positions of exercising malign influence and power against us. Let me turn to another topic that I know you've been very concerned about. You wrote a piece, a powerful piece in the Baltimore Sun about it recently, Sam, and that is the fact that we seem to be studiously ignoring, and you went after the media in particular, but I think it's the government as well, for that matter. Certainly the public is in the dark about the turn, if you will, of ISIS, the Islamic State, now doing business under the brand ISIS-K. Right. Tell us a little bit about those guys, Sam, and what evidence there is that we should be paying a lot more attention to them.
Well, look, ISIS-K is an offshoot of ISIS. ISIS-K, K stands for Khorasan, which is an old term for portions of Iran and Afghanistan, whatever. These are the guys who basically think all the rest of the jihadis are not hardcore enough. These are the guys, as somebody smarter than me has said, who want to get their jihad on right now. We're not dithering. We're going to go out and kill and slay and blow things up and do whatever we can right now, all day, every day. They've staged a whole series of attacks. Moscow was not the first, and it's not going to be the last, and really no surprise. And they have made their, as all these guys do, their intentions crystal clear for a long time. If you're listening, and we are 100% on the list. And one of the big problem that the Russians had was, even though we told them we have an intelligence that says not just they're coming to attack you, but actually named the concert hall, and they still couldn't find the attack team and stop them. That's the Russians with no civil liberties concern. Why? Because they're awash in Central Asians, Tajiks and Kazakhs, some legal and a lot of them illegal. There are a whole basically cities of Central Asians in Russia now. All these people living off the books. Even the Russians could not find them, even though we told them this, you're looking for a team. Okay, You know, Sam, the exact same problem here.
That's what I just wanted to say. This sounds awfully familiar. Yes. Talk a little bit about that quickly.
Well, not just in the sense that we have a problem with the illegals. We have a problem specifically with a pipeline of folks coming out of Central Asia into the United States. So we've got Tajiks, and all these guys were Tajiks, coming into the United States in large numbers all day, every day. You have no idea who they are.
Sam, hold the thought, please. We've got to take another break. You were going up against these guys, this Sharia supremacist attitude, shall we say, under whatever banner. You know a lot about them, and we're going to talk about what it means that it's not just Tajiks or Central Asians, but a whole bunch of other jihadis that are here now, too. Be right back with more with Sam Faddis. Stay tuned.
After night in cities across the country, black garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
We're back, and we're continuing our weekly conversation with Sam Faddis, former CIA undercover operative, and who conducted himself with great distinction in very dangerous places around the world on our behalf. We cannot adequately express our appreciation for that, as well as the work that he does these days at AND Magazine at Substack.com. Sam, I wanted just to tease out a little bit further, having talked about how our allies in the region are making what sense they can of this situation where we have what you call a controlled asset of the Chinese Communist Party sitting in the Oval Office of the United States and discussing with them what needs to be done to protect against the CCP. What do you think the Chinese Communist Party is making of this arrangement? Would you anticipate that it is emboldening them to act ever more aggressively, not just again in the region, not just against the Japanese or the Filipinos or even the Taiwanese, but against us as well, perhaps here at home?
Yeah, well, again, it seems like with a number of these matters, I mean, part of the answer is tradecraft and intelligence and how this world works, which is a little arcane. And part of it is just reality and common sense and the way people work. I mean, if you've gotten a guy to take $31 million from you over a course of years, and I would submit to you, by this point, you have a track record of one decision after another that favors communist China to the detriment of the United States of America. You do not then strategically make moves and plan and ignore this. This is must become the centerpiece of what you're doing. We have achieved unthinkable success. We have a completely I'm speaking now as, you know, from the Chinese perspective. We got a completely compromised guy sitting in the Oval Office. You don't then plan your moves against Taiwan or anybody else and ignore this central reality, which is why, you know, we've had so many conversations about timing. Okay, are you as Xi going to wait until, I mean, let's assume, for instance, Donald Trump wins the November election. Are you then going to wait until he sits down in the Oval Office to really make your big move on things? As it becomes increasingly likely that that may happen, are you going to ignore that? Obviously not. I mean, this has long since shifted from one of these days we may have a problem to, no, guys, we got a problem right now, like today, we got a problem.
Yeah. And Sam, I guess this comes back to the point that we were just discussing a moment ago about, you know, a controlled asset. If Joe Biden is under the control of the Chinese Communist Party, not only is the opportunity perceived to be advantageous to the CCP, but the prospect that he would actually do what they tell him to do in the course of whatever attack they are going to mount. And it could run the gamut, as you know better than just about anybody, from cyber to biological to physical sabotage and so on. That has to be, I think, uppermost in our minds. And again, it brings me back to a point that with your help, we distilled out of the myriad webinars that our Committee on the Present Danger China sponsored, co-sponsored by the Center for Security Policy. And you can find out all about it at centerforsecuritypolicy.org, as well as at presentdangerchina.org. But we talked about the fact that along with lots of other friends of China, captured elites, as they're called, the president is in a position to do even more harm. I think you said his track record bespeaks a predilection for doing the bidding. I think it's an unbroken track record, actually. I think you do, yes, too. So if push comes to shove and you know, the move against Taiwan is in the offing, I think we agree that Joe Biden would probably be susceptible to being told to help the success of that operation here. And why, as we say in the indictment, you don't want people who have this kind of record anywhere near the reins of power, do you?
As we've said before, the man could not get a job on the loading dock at the Central Intelligence Agency. With all his contacts, screams off the paper. Look, if the I've said this many times, the Chinese flip on a blockade of Taiwan tomorrow, which we both know they're in the, they could do that anytime. The only thing missing is the announcement that it's in place, because the ships, the aircraft are there already all day, every day. Will Joe Biden order a breaking of that blockade and move? No. He will issue some sort of statement. He will ask for the UN to hold discussions. This Taiwanese will starve. They will knuckle under. They will become the next Hong Kong, and he will watch. And can anybody say, given what you know factually about his contacts, the money that has flowed to him, his track record of decisions, are you really going to be able to write a history book after that and say, wow, we didn't see that one coming? That was a shocker. I mean, talk about the elephant in the room. This is the biggest elephant in history we are ignoring.
Arguably, yeah. You know, it's often said, history is written by the victors. So this one is not likely to be told from our preview, needless to say, unless we get cracking on getting on a war footing and getting people like Joe Biden out of positions of exercising malign influence and power against us. Let me turn to another topic that I know you've been very concerned about. You wrote a piece, a powerful piece in the Baltimore Sun about it recently, Sam, and that is the fact that we seem to be studiously ignoring, and you went after the media in particular, but I think it's the government as well, for that matter. Certainly the public is in the dark about the return, if you will, of ISIS, the Islamic State, now doing business under the brand ISIS-K. Right. Tell us a little bit about those guys, Sam, and what evidence there is that we should be paying a lot more attention to them.
Well, ISIS-K is an offshoot of ISIS. ISIS-K, K stands for Khorasan, which is an old term for portions of Iran and Afghanistan, whatever. These are the guys who basically think all the rest of the jihadis are not hardcore enough. These are the guys, as somebody smarter than me has said, who want to get their jihad on right now. We're not dithering. We're going to go out and kill and slay and blow things up and do whatever we can right now, all day, every day. They've staged a whole series of attacks. Moscow was not the first, and it's not going to be the last, and really no surprise. And they have made their, as all these guys do, their intentions crystal clear for a long time. If you're listening, and we are 100% on the list. And one of the big problem that the Russians had was, even though we told them we have an intelligence that says not just they're coming to attack you, but actually named the concert hall, and they still couldn't find the attack team and stop them. That's the Russians with no civil liberties concern. Why? Because they're awash in Central Asians, Tajiks and Kazakhs, some legal and a lot of them illegal. There are a whole basically cities of Central Asians in Russia now. All these people living off the books. Even the Russians could not find them, even though we told them this. You're looking for a team. Okay.
You know,
the
Sam,
exact same problem here.
That's what I just wanted to say. This sounds awfully familiar.
Yes.
Talk a little bit about that quickly.
Well, not just in the sense that we have a problem with the illegals. We have a problem specifically with a pipeline of folks coming out of Central Asia into the United States. So we've got Tajiks, and all these guys were Tajiks, coming into the United States in large numbers all day, every day. You have no idea who they are.
Sam, hold the thought, please. We've got to take another break. You were going up against these guys, this Sharia supremacist attitude, shall we say, under whatever banner. You know a lot about them, and we're going to talk about what it means that it's not just Tajiks or Central Asians, but a whole bunch of other jihadis that are here now, too. Be right back with more with Sam Pattis. Stay tuned. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Yesterday, Japan's Prime Minister Fumio Kishida urged Americans to overcome, quote, an undercurrent of self-doubt about our role in a world now at history's turning point, unquote. Actually, what millions of us are doubting is the quality of our leadership at such a moment. Top congressmen warn that we're in a new Cold War with the Chinese Communist Party and are finally launching hearings into the CCP's political warfare here. There's an elephant in the room, however, that is yet to be formally acknowledged, let alone corrected. As retired CIA spy Sam Pattis has observed, in the lexicon of recruiting and running agents, President Joe Biden would be characterized as, quote, a controlled asset of the Chinese Communist Party, unquote.
We can't win a Cold War, let alone the now looming hot one, with a leader whose loyalty and conduct we have plenty of reason to doubt. This is Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and I'm always excited to be able to say we have a chance to visit with Itamar Marcus. He's a man I've come to admire tremendously. Based in Israel, he is one of the go-to resources on what is actually going on in the Palestinian community, specifically what is being incited in that community by the so-called leadership of it. And I'm not talking just about Hamas here. I'm talking about the so-called good guys, the Palestinian Authority. Itamar's outfit is called Palestinian Media Watch, and he brings to us a daily stream of the sorts of, incitement that we see still coming out of the people that the Biden administration insists are the great white hope, if I can call them that, for a two-state solution. They'll take over in Gaza and all will be well. Itamar, it's great to have you back. Thank you for taking a few minutes to visit with us and update us on your work.
Thank you for inviting me, Frank.
I want to start, if I may, by asking you about the latest output, shall we say, of the Palestinian Authority, its political arm Fatah, and whether in fact they are conducting themselves in a manner that bespeaks the professed, at least the imputed, willingness to live side by side in peace with Israel, not just on the West Bank or Gaza, the Judea Samaria area, but also in Gaza.
Yeah, so Frank, there's no real change in the Palestinian Authority messages to their people. I would say one of the dominant themes of the PA world is the continuous glorifying of terrorists. And just for example, this week, a terrorist who'd been in jail for almost 40 years, Walid Dakka, who murdered an Israeli 40 years ago, after he died, The Palestinian press and the official statements of the leadership, they turned this murderer into a superhero. You're a role model. We'll always remember you. He died in prison from cancer, and they're blaming Israel for the cancer. So you've got two different types of incitement. There's the incitement to hatred because they're saying Israel intentionally killed him in prison. And then what you have is the incitement to kill by saying that this person who murdered an Israeli, and in fact, there was apparently torture involved as well. He was kidnapped and then tortured, is a role model. So these are two things. You have to hate. And once you have the hate, you have to convince them that you can even go and kill.
Yeah. And what, based on your analysis, is the cumulative effect of this kind of indoctrination, which has been going on, I think, incessantly during intifadas, yes, of course, but also during the so-called peaceful periods of the Palestinian Authority's rather illegitimate lifespan?
The impact is it's cumulative over so many years, as you're saying, and the cumulative message is that for every Palestinian understands that the heroes and the way you become a hero is by killing an Israeli, by going to jail. And by the way, I want to point out, it's not just a national hero. you are also an Islamic hero. The killing of Israelis, attacking Israelis, is presented as a religious act for Islam by the Palestinian Authority. And there is absolutely no doubt about this. This is not just Hamas. This is the Palestinian Authority. And I'll just give you one proof of it. Every terrorist who has ever killed an Israeli and died in the act is called a shaheed. Shaheed means he died for Allah, means he gets rewarded from Allah. There has never been, no matter how cruel the terror attack, there has never been a terrorist who the Palestinian Authority has admitted was a terrorist. And if they were killed, every single one of them is called a martyr for Allah, gets rewarded from Allah, gets the highest rewards from Allah. So Palestinian Authority has created a society where children grow up believing that the right thing to do, the ethical thing to do, the moral thing to do, what God wants you to do, is to kill Israelis.
And Itamar, as you mentioned, they get a reward from Allah, ostensibly, but they also get a reward from the Palestinian Authority, do they not? And where do the funds come for that?
Yeah, absolutely. If they go to jail, they start getting a salary immediately. And the longer they're in jail, the higher the salary goes, reaching up to 12,000 shekel, which is almost $4,000, which is about four times the average Palestinian Authority salary. Four times. So they become very, very rich in jail. And for example, this Walid Dakka, who'd been in 40 years, he had hundreds of thousands of dollars in salary in his bank account. And had he been released in another year, like had been scheduled, he had his life sentence was commuted in, as a gesture to the PA. Had he left jail in a year, he would have come out a rich man. Everybody would say, "Oh, there's Walid Dakka, the very rich man. I want to be like him." He would drive around the cars, and then he becomes a role model. How do you become a superhero role model? Kill an Israeli.
Right. And in addition to the individuals in prison getting a stipend, their families, as I understand it, especially the ones that have been martyred, are also rewarded. And again, Itamar, remind us, where does the money come from for this purpose?
So a terrorist who is killed in the act of attacking Israelis, even suicide bombers, their family gets a lifetime monthly stipend. And again, it's a very, very significant amount of money, considering it's for life. And this money has come from many, many years, until we exposed this actually in 2011. It was coming directly from the Western donor countries, because they were not concerned at all, including the United States, just giving money without blindly to the Palestinian Authority, even though they supported glorified terror. And then when we exposed that they were actually paying terrorists, so then the United States and many European countries went into this stage of, I call it the willful blindness stage, where they said, okay, we're not going to give them money in the general budget. We will pay their budget expenses. We'll pay the teachers. We'll pay for sewage pipes. We'll pay for drilling water. We're not going to, but the deal, it's a deal with the devil. You're doing this to enable the Palestinian Authority to reward terrorists. It is immoral.
And it's been illegal in the United States, and yet that seems to nonetheless be continuing in some form or fashion. Itamar, we have to take a short break. When we come back on, and just complete that thought and then ask you about what does all this indoctrination do in practice to make the areas under Palestinian Authority control very dangerous indeed. Be right back with that and more with Itamar Marcus right after this. We're back. Itamar Marcus is in the house virtually. We've caught up with him in Israel, where he resides and does incredibly important work with the PalestinianMediaWatch.org. And I believe that's, PalMediaWatch.org. Is that right? PalWatch.org. There we go. Follow it, if you could, please, because it helps explain an awful lot of what's going on in all of this. Itamar, I did want to ask you, having established that the Palestinian Authority is still very much in the business of promoting jihad and rewarding it, including with our money, taxpayer money, what is the current state of play in Judea and Samaria in terms of the threats that Israeli citizens are facing there, and for that matter, Palestinians who want to do business with them or otherwise get along may be facing as well?
So the whole population in Judea Samaria, what they call the West Bank, has been completely radicalized. All the hatred that I was describing before in the education, all the messages has seeped into the hearts and souls of the Judean Samaria Arabs, the West Bank Arabs, the Palestinian Authority, so-called moderate Arabs. For that reason, what we see, for example, is in polls, do you support what happened on October 7th, the atrocities of October 7th? Do you support what Hamas did? They're much higher today in Judea and Samaria than they are in Gaza. They're up to, I think, 80% or so. And the reason is very simple, is that in Gaza, they suffered the war, so the numbers are down. But in Judea and Samaria, they're just busy still celebrating the murder of Israelis. So the population there and the leadership there are completely, I would say, anti-peace, anti-reconciliation with Israel, anti-accepting Israel's right to exist.
As we've talked about, there is also this nutty little problem that we've created an army for them, so-called security forces that are being mobilized and weaponized for the purpose of aiding, you know, the killing of Jews. Is that not correct?
That's correct. And the United States not only has funded this, but the United States actually sent over a general and armed forces to Jordan, and the Palestinian Authority police were trained in being snipers, trained in using all sorts of automatic weapons, and they've been using them very, very actively against Israel. This we know. We recently did a report on this. Very, very much involved in terror. And in fact, there was a statement just on TV, I think it was this past week, a Fatah leader said that just like in the past, when the West Bank exploded in the intifadas and terror waves, when the Palestinian police took an active role, he said, so too, when it happens again, they're going to take an active role.
You know, it's just unimaginable, but we are turning a blind eye to all of this, as you say, and it is extraordinarily dangerous to be doing so. On the positive side, you mentioned that support for the jihad, or Hamas specifically, is down somewhat in Gaza, where they have suffered the consequences of what was done on October 7th. I have seen some clips of Palestinians, men in the street, expressing their hatred for Hamas and what has befallen them as a result of its activities. How widespread would you say is that sentiment at this point? And are these just individuals who are courageously, but dangerously, presumably, spouting off? Or is this reflective of a real change, do you think?
Okay, so that's one of the real difficult questions. It certainly isn't real change. It might be pragmatic at this point to believe that they all of a sudden, because they hate Hamas, because they brought war on them, that they are accepting Israel's right to exist is absolutely is absolutely not correct. They might hate the Hamas leadership. One of the people who I heard interviewed, he said he hates the Hamas leadership. They don't want the Palestinian Authority leadership. And then he said, what we would like is to have an Israeli civil administration running Gaza. They're the only people who were always good to us, which is, of course, ironic. Israel left Gaza, in 2006. And we thought, unilaterally, the world thanked us for it. And now there are Palestinians. To what extent that's a sentiment? I believe it's a real sentiment. I don't believe he's the only person. Is it 5%, 30%? I do not know. the Palestinians in Gaza have suffered so much, both from Hamas, and they know that the PA is no better, is just as corrupt. It might be that a lot of them would actually prefer to have Israel come back. Of course, the world would never accept such a thing because it doesn't fit their ideology that the Palestinian Authority is a potential leader.
Yeah. I also saw a clip yesterday, Itamar, and I don't know if you've encountered it or not. It was of an Israeli Arab denouncing Hamas and basically the jihadi enterprise. He seemed to be a fairly secular fellow, I have to say, and very much was extolling the fact that he could eat during Ramadan and he could live freely in Israel. So this may be just a complete outlier and somebody who would be, you know, considered not only an infidel, but a blasphemer and all that. What's the state of play as you see it at the moment with Israeli Arab sentiment? And is there a real danger of a fifth column inside Israel at this point, do you think?
The answer is yes and yes. The Israeli Arabs primarily, the polls initially were the Israeli Arabs completely rejected. I think it was 80% rejected what Hamas did. And that's very significant. They were horrified. Israeli Arabs have been westernized to a large extent. They work in Israeli hospitals. They've gone to Israeli universities, many of them. They have business with Israelis. The thought of what was done, the atrocities, horrified them. And I would say beyond that, there were a number of significant videos of Israeli Arabs being tortured and murdered by Hamas. And they, you heard them begging
On the 7th of October?
On the 7th of October. A lot of Israel, a lot of dozens were killed. And they were screaming, I'm Israeli Arab. And they were killed anyway. And the Israeli Arab population all saw those videos. And they said, my God, they're killing us too. These. So that made them. Now, as far as your question, fifth column, you don't need more than 20% to have a very, very dangerous fifth column. You don't even need more than 5% or 3% to have a dangerous fifth column. We have had a lot of terror. I wouldn't say a lot. We've had significant terror from East Jerusalem Arabs. Walid Dhaka, by the way, who I mentioned.
We have to leave it at that, I'm afraid, Itamar Marcus. Thank you for your time and expertise. Great work at Palestinian Media Watch. I hope people follow you at palmediawatch.org. God bless.
Palmedia.org.
Palwatch.org. I got it right. Thank you, Itamar. Come back to us soon, if you would. I hope the rest of you do the same next time. Until then, go forth and multiply.